This is Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This is our 57th episode. We call it Polar Bear and invite on the show Todd Atwood, research wildlife biologist and project leader for the Polar Bear Research Program at the USGS Alaska Science Center in Anchorage, Alaska. This, the first of a two-episode series on polar bears, we want to get the science perspective on this large carnivore from the north. As I said at the outset, tonight we're joined by Todd Atwood, research wildlife biologist and project leader for the Polar Bear Research Program at the USGS Alaska Science Center in Anchorage, Alaska. His work, if you do a quick Google search, shows up in terms of in the news, certainly in Alaska, at the Anchorage Daily News through the Alaska Public Media, but also on a national level. In the Washington Post, and also in more widely distributed, or just as widely distributed, national and international journals and magazines like New Scientist, National Geographic, and the Smithsonian. So definitely in conversation, Dr. Atwood is with a public audience and whose voice comes through in the public science media. Polar bears are a hot topic right now, and I think it's good to have that science, that scientist perspective. You know, the bear itself is seen as an icon of climate change, and maybe we want to really look at that a little closer. So tonight, we're speaking with a scientist who's been working with polar bears over the last decade and who gives us this more of a research-based perspective. We divide tonight's episode into five parts. The first part, we ask the question about where the bears are. What's the distribution of the bear population and subpopulations across the circumpolar north? And then how do we know that? So how do we know where they are? And that requires tracking. And how do we actually, what is the logistics of doing tracking? And so Todd shares that with us in some of his expertise. In part two, we ask, what are the conditions to find bears? What does it look like? We need ice. We need a seal population. What are the characteristics of those places where we might find bears? And then we also get into the bear in water and the bear on land in terms of mobility, and looking at their speeds in both as both swimmers and walkers. Part three, who are the predators of the polar bears? And really, I think what I wanted to get at here is what are the main causes of polar bear death? And that leads us to a discussion of the age structure of the subpopulation. So something we talk about in classes here, population pyramids. So what does that look like for the polar bear populations? How long do polar bears even live? So a lot of the discussion about the age structure of the populations. Part four, really kind of warming up, I think, through the first three parts, but to get to part four, which is the highly debatable global population, what's happening to the global population of polar bears. And so under current climate change scenario models, what does the future of the polar bear look like? And lastly, the question of will they migrate? Is that even something that scientists are starting to see? And then lastly, in part five, We take the opportunity of speaking and take advantage of the opportunity of speaking with a scientist, a research scientist, a research wildlife biologist about the common misconceptions about polar bears. And I think you'll find the answers pretty interesting. With nothing else, let's start our conversation with Todd Atwood.
How far does the extent of the distribution of different polar bear populations reach? Are they limited to just what we think of as the far north?
No, you know, I think people would probably be surprised to know how far south polar bears range. So, you know, generally, when we talk about polar bear distribution, yeah, we make it a point to say that they're unevenly distributed. And really, what drives their historic and their present-day distribution is the availability of sea ice. So they have a circumpolar distribution. They're distributed around, you know, the North Pole, in areas where sea ice is mostly available throughout the year. That said, they can range as far south as the 51 degree northern latitude mark, which would put them down at the southern tip of southern Hudson Bay, which is actually an area called James Bay. That's a large portion of southern Hudson Bay at the southern extreme that's shared between Ontario and Quebec. And so that puts them, you know, pretty far south.
Is that Churchill?
Further south than most people realize.
Is that the town of Churchill that they reach to? Is that
Churchill is in western Hudson Bay, which is north of southern Hudson Bay.
Oh, okay. I'm
not sure what towns are down by southern Hudson Bay. There's a big island there called Akamiski Island, which is where polar bears from the southern Hudson Bay subpopulation tend to aggregate during the summer and fall because there's no sea ice coverage in the Hudson Bay region that time of year. So they haul out on land and wait for the ice to return in the fall.
And you're based in Alaska, so when you're looking at the distribution in Alaska, how far sort of down the western coast or how far into places beyond just Barrow, Alaska are polar bears going?
Well, so, yeah, in Alaska we have two subpopulations, the southern Beaufort Sea subpopulation, which kind of ranges off the northern coast of Alaska, and then the Chukchi Sea subpopulation, which ranges down the western coast of Alaska. Southern Beaufort subpopulation shared with Canada, Chukchi Sea is shared with Russia. And the Chukchi Sea subpopulation extends quite a bit further south than the northern Beaufort. It's not common, but it occasionally happens where you have bears that move through the Bering Strait into the northern Bering Sea if the ice is you know, down there for any measurable amount of time. That's typically in winter. You get a few bears that'll range down through the Bering Strait, spend a little bit of time in the Bering Sea, and then come back up as the ice retreats through the Bering Strait.
Yeah.
But typically, you don't see a lot of that. It's kind of a, you know, once in every couple of years, you'll see a radio collared bear that'll wander down through the Bering Strait.
So you're able to track the polar bears through GPS collars to kind of map out then this movement?
Yeah, we use, you know, a variety of tools to monitor distribution and movement, and so GPS collars are one tool. We've kind of moved away from using collars to using satellite ear tags and satellite gluon transmitters. They don't give you as much data because the battery life is shorter, so they don't give you as much data as the radio collars, but they're a lot lighter.
Yeah.
You know, the ear tags weigh about 26 grams, so it's something that the bear doesn't really notice. So they're just a lot more easier on the animal. And that trade-off between getting less data but being, you know, easier on the animal, less intrusive in how you sample the animal and how you might fit the animal with, you know, different types of sensors and tags is something that I think is pretty important for the research community to kind of constantly be striving to kind of improve.
How many times have you had to attach a collar or one of these chips on a satellite chip on a bear? Have you done this many times personally?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been working with polar bears now for 8 years. It used to be that we would put radio collars on, you know, upwards of 20 bears every spring.
Yeah.
Last couple of years, we've switched away from the radio collars and we're using the glue-on tags and the ear tags.
Yeah.
The glue-on tags are kind of interesting because, you know, the polar bears, they blow out their coat. They molt their hair.
Yeah.
They start blowing out their coat in May, kind of later end of May, early June. And when you glue on those ear tags, you're basically shaving a little spot in between the shoulder blades of the bear. You use like an epoxy type glue to glue the tag on. And then it lasts for about 45 to 60 days because the bear molts the coat and you lose the tag. The tag just falls off when the hair comes out.
How do you get to be so close to the bear? Do you have to tranquilize it?
Yeah, so typically what we do is we try and do an annual field effort, and that's in the spring. And you try and time the field effort to coincide with the time of year where you start to have longer days so you can work longer.
Yeah.
And you also need to still have pretty good sea ice conditions that you can work on. So typically what happens is we go out in the middle of March, start our field season, go out for about 5 or 6 weeks. And by the time we're wrapping things up, say the middle of April, the end of April, the ice is beginning to deteriorate. It's beginning to fracture. Mm-hmm. And that causes some changes in the weather, creates more fog, it gets more moisture in the air. And so it gets to the point where it's just not really logistically or economically feasible to continue working.
Right.
And so we go out and do most of our work via helicopter. Yeah. We fly over areas where we think we're likely to encounter polar bears. What we do is we fly over hunting habitat where bears are likely to be hunting ring seals because that's primarily what they feed on.
Yeah.
And we just look for tracks. And when we encounter tracks, we forward track the bears. So we follow those tracks as the bear is moving forward. And once we visualize a bear, we search for ice that we can work the bear on, meaning, you know, a nice flat pan of ice that is not too close to any obstructions or open water. And then we'll do a darting run. We dart the bear with a dart that has a tranquilizer drug.
Uh-huh.
And then it takes about, you know, 5 to 10 minutes for the bear to become immobilized from the drug. And then we land and spend about 45 minutes collecting data from the bear.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
So you mentioned that they primarily are eating seals. If we were to sort of list the criteria of how you find a bear, it sounds like it's where the seals are, where the ice is. What are some of the other factors that kind of tell us, you know, if we were to ask the question, where do we find the bears? These are the things that you would be looking for.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, you know, you're definitely going to find a polar bear where the polar bears are going to find their food. And in the springtime, that's primarily ring seals. And so ring seals like to hang out in areas where sea ice is fairly contiguous, but there are fractures in the ice, too, that create these little ribbons of open water that we call leads. And what they'll do is they'll maintain breathing holes in those leads because, you know, it's still really cold out there. It's, you know, when we're doing our work, it's anywhere from negative 30 Fahrenheit to maybe 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So even though there are these little ribbons of open water between fractured ice sheets or adjacent ice flows, it's still slushy kind of water, and it freezes over pretty quickly. And so what seals do, what ring seals do, is they maintain these breathing holes in those leads. And they've got claws on their pectoral fins, the fins that are kind of off their the side of their chest.
Yeah.
And they'll use their claws to kind of scrape these breathing holes open, and they'll pop up every so often, just kind of pop their nose through the hole to grab air, and they'll submerge again. And they're feeding primarily on Arctic cod, so the seals are swimming around trying to feed on cod. And the polar bears are looking for those little leads, those slushy leads. And in particular, they're looking for those breathing holes.
Yeah.
And what they'll do is they'll find a breathing hole, and they'll sit over the top of it and just wait for a seal to pop up and catch some air. And that's when they'll try and grab the seal.
Do they swim after them?
Yeah, you know, we have some really interesting. So a couple of years ago, we put out some GPS radio collars that also were equipped with cameras. And so they recorded video, kind of point of view video of the bears interacting with other bears, but also hunting. And we have some really interesting footage of bears creating their own, like, sham, fake breathing holes for seals. And, you know, if you were a seal, it's probably a pretty, you know, a pretty enticing thing to find, this nice big breathing hole where you can pop up and you don't have to invest any energy in excavating it. Well, so polar bears will dig these holes and they'll sit over the top of them. And we've got a couple of instances where a polar bear actually dives through the hole and chases a seal for a stretch of time under the water. Doesn't catch it because the seals are just way too fast and agile for the bears underwater. But they will do that. They'll also swim through the water and kind of swim through underneath fragmented floes and smaller patches of ice.
Yeah.
And try and ambush seals that are hauled out on those patches of ice by kind of sneaking up behind them.
But in general, they are good swimmers, polar bears. They swim pretty fast.
Oh, they are. They're really good swimmers. You know, they're a marine mammal. They're a little bit odd for a marine mammal in that they spend most of their time out of the water.
Yeah.
You know, they spend most of their time over the water on the sea ice, but they're definitely adept at swimming in the water. The one thing they lack, though, in terms of swimming, is they don't have much of a streamline. You know, they swim kind of like a dog paddle. And so, you know, they've got really big feet that helps propel them through the water. But they don't have much of a rotation around kind of a center axis, so they're not generating much of a streamline. So while they're good at swimming and they have no qualms about going in the water no matter what the temperature is,
right.
It's still more energetically expensive for them to swim than it is for them to walk on the ice.
They're faster swimmers than you and I are.
Probably, yeah. But they've definitely got more stamina. I mean, some of we've observed a number of cases of long distance swims by radio tag bears, and it's amazing how much time they can spend in the water swimming.
Like
so
miles?
They've got the stamina, like, but like, they're probably more like, you know, if you're into swimming competitions, they're probably more like a 1500 meter freestyler than they are a 50 meter sprinter.
Right. When you say long distances, are we talking miles, like marathon distance swimming?
Oh yeah. So we've, you know, our group published a paper a couple of years back that looked at 50 long distance swims by polar bears over a relatively short amount of time, just a handful of years.
Yeah.
And what we found was that the mean distance of these swims, so these are occurring during the open water season when there's no ice available in the southern Beaufort.
Right.
The median distance of those swims was about 150 kilometers.
Wow.
And the bears were in the water anywhere from, you know, three days to 10 days. Oh. Now, it doesn't mean that they're swimming constantly and swimming constantly through that entire time. They're probably encountering little pieces of ice that they can haul out and rest on.
Yeah.
But, that's a really long distance swim, being in the water for, you know, 150 plus kilometers for multiple days, dealing with currents, with waves, all those things that make kind of open water swimming challenging. The longest swim that we saw was nearly 700 kilometers and took the bear about 10 days to complete.
Wow. And how do these distances compare to what they're and the speed too, compared to what they do on land. They're going to beat us because a black bear might beat me in a 50-meter dash. Is a polar bear just much bigger and is not going to do the short distance fast? And how far are they willing to walk in terms of these long distances?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and a lot of the swimming versus walking speed depends on whether the bears are moving with or against the current, and there can be some pretty strong currents in the Arctic Ocean.
Sure.
We've seen typical swimming speeds of anywhere from 1 to 4 kilometers per hour. And I think at the higher end there, that's bears being assisted by the current, so they're moving with the current.
Yeah.
And it lines up pretty well with movement rates on ice and land, which are, you know, somewhere around the 2 to 3 kilometer per hour range. It's tough to know what the maximum speed of a polar bear in water would be.
Yeah.
I don't think we have a really good handle on that. My guess is it's probably not much higher than that, you know, 4 kilometer per hour threshold, unless you just get really strong currents and strong winds that move the bear quickly. But the maximum speed on land is probably close to you know, 40 kilometers per hour, extrapolated to an hour, which is, you know, roughly 25 miles per hour. Obviously, a bear can't sustain that speed for that long, but that would be the hour equivalency of it.
So they'd be fast at that 50-meter dash as well.
Yeah, you know, I think people get surprised by how fast bears are because they have a lumbering gait. You know, they just don't look agile or quick,
right.
But they are.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
These long-distance swims, walking across multiple miles or kilometers, is there anything that, does the polar bear have a predator? I mean, are they seeking refuge sometimes on sea ice? Is that just to save energy, or are they leaving the water because something might challenge them, an orca or a whale, or... Do they have a predator? And I guess this leads also to my bigger question is sort of what is the most common death for a polar bear?
Yeah, so, you know, what preys on polar bears, that's, I think the two main predators of polar bears are people and other polar bears.
And other polar bears,
you know, there are, of course, to take a step back, we talked about the distribution of polar bears. So that circumpolar distribution covers 5 Arctic nations, the U.S., Canada, Greenland, Norway, and Russia. And the U.S., Canada, Greenland, and soon to be Russia have or will have hunting seasons for polar bears. And these are primarily harvest seasons that are available to indigenous peoples of kind of northern communities. So that makes, you know, people one of the predators of polar bears. We do see cases where, for instance, adult males will kill cubs of the year. They'll encounter a family group, a mom and her cubs, and they'll kill one or both of the cubs. In fact, we saw a case of that this past spring during our field work. Hmm. We have seen cases where a yearling was killed by another bear, and this is probably, again, being killed by a larger adult. We certainly see a lot of cases where the males that we capture are pretty beaten up, and it's from males fighting other males for dominance during the breeding season.
Yeah.
And, you know, there might be instances where a male that's on the losing side of a fight sustains a mortal injury and dies from that. But in terms of common causes of death for a polar bear, it's a really hard question to answer because it's so difficult to first find a dead bear and then be able to get to it in a timely manner where you can determine the cause of death. Really, the, you know, aside from just kind of opportunistically coming across a dead bear, the only other reliable way to do it would be to have a bear that's got a radio collar on. Radio collars typically have mortality sensors, so when the collar is stationary for a certain amount of time, it emits a different type of transmission cycle.
Yeah.
And then you go and investigate that animal. You get to that site, you investigate the animal, you do a necropsy, you kind of consider what evidence you see at the scene, kind of do your own you know, polar bear CSI routine. The problem is it's, you know, you might get a mortality signal and, you know, I'm sitting 800 miles away in Anchorage and the bear's on the sea ice in the Beaufort Sea, and it's going to take me probably several weeks to get a helicopter that I can go visit the site. The sea ice is drifting. I have to be able to, you know, fly out far enough on the sea ice so that I can, you know, investigate the site, but then be able to return because helicopters have, you know, limited fuel capacities. So there are a lot of logistics and costs associated with trying to investigate, say, a mortality signal from a radio collar that just aren't trivial. It just makes it really hard to do. When you look at studies that have been able to do that, some of the leading causes of death include hunting, include starvation.
Right.
Of course, you get a number of animals that die from old age. They can't feed efficiently anymore, and so that's kind of sometimes commingled with starvation. There have been cases where bears have drowned. They've been caught, you know, doing these long-distance swims in the open water during a storm event.
Yeah.
And they've drowned during the swim, and then they'll wash up, you know, on shore, and somebody will find them and do a necropsy and find that the lungs were full of water. And then there are also, you know, cases of intraspecific killing where one polar bear kills another polar bear, and that's primarily adult males killing cubs.
What's the life expectancy, sort of, the when you're saying a bear that maybe dies of old age, how many years are we talking?
Yeah, so I think it's pretty common for us to routinely see bears in their late teens.
Yeah.
We've also, though, seen plenty of bears in their mid-20s. As you get into the late 20s, though, it becomes more and more rare. I think the oldest bear that we've recorded in our data set was 32 years old.
Wow.
That's not very common that you see a bear over, you know, 25, 26.
If there was a population pyramid of the bear population around the world, are we looking at a real pyramid here of a lot of younger? So the females are having maybe two cubs. Is that happening, or is it a pretty standard? So each age group here, whether you do it by 1 or 5 years or whatever, each age group's about equal. Or how does that? How might that look?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the age structure of any given subpopulation probably is shaped by the types of stressors that those subpopulations are experiencing. And so, for example, if it's a subpopulation that has a relatively high harvest, you're probably going to have an age structure that's a little bit skewed towards younger bears. You won't have a lot of older bears.
Yeah.
I think a quote-unquote natural age structure would have a relatively large amount of cubs,
yeah,
smaller amount of yearlings, because there's usually a survival bottleneck between being a cub of the year and reaching your first year of age.
Yeah.
Survivorship tends to decline a little bit for 2 year olds too, and through the subadult period, so 2 to 4 years old. Most bears reach sexual maturity at 5 years old, so we call adults anything that's 5 years and older. And you tend to see relatively stable age structure between, say 5 and 15, 16 years of age. So, pretty much equal numbers of individuals in those different annual age ranges. And then it begins to tail off again as you get older. So the largest, I guess the pyramid would be kind of broadest in that the base of the pyramid would be that 5 to 18 year old age group.
So
kind of the prime age individuals.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
What's your estimate? What's the science say? What's the scientific community saying about the estimated worldwide population of polar bears? How many would you count?
Yeah. Well, that can be a hot button issue, and that
right.
can be, from a scientist's perspective, I tend to, we talk a lot in science about degrees of certainty. How certain are we about the things that we contend are happening? And I think with abundance estimates, certainty is a really important consideration. And not to get too sciencey, but, when you talk about abundance, you're usually talking about a point estimate. We think there are 1,000 animals in this population. And then the uncertainty is characterized by a confidence interval. But that number could also range somewhere between 500 and 1,500 animals. With kind of the circumpolar population of polar bears, I think the most realistic response is we don't have a firm estimate of how many bears there are.
Yeah.
We think based on what we know for many of the subpopulations that it's probably somewhere in the 20,000 to 30,000 individual range. And so people tend to just kind of settle on 25,000 individuals.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to know that that's really, a best guesstimate.
Right.
And the reason why is there are 19 subpopulations of polar bears. And these aren't, I don't mean to imply that they're genetically discrete units. They're really kind of management units. But there are 19 subpopulations of polar bears, and as an example of the degree of uncertainty about this circumpolar abundance estimate, of those 19 subpopulations, we have recent abundance estimates, and recent being, say, within the last 10 years, for only 7 of those subpopulations. So that leaves 12 subpopulations that we don't have any abundance estimate for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And there are several subpopulations, for example, the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, the Arctic Basin, where we've never had an abundance estimate. So, you know, the 25,000 individual abundance estimate that gets kind of used a lot, I think the big caveat is there's a lot of uncertainty that surrounds that.
Again, I guess on this topic of science, the scientific community, what's the major challenge to this estimated 25,000 polar bears? What, with the current predictions and current models for climate change scenarios, what's the future look like for polar bears?
Well, the main, I guess, impediment to having updated abundance estimates for the 19 subpopulations is really financial. There is a logistical component too. We're kind of lucky in Alaska in that, from a logistics perspective, it's easier to study polar bears here than it is to, say, study polar bears in Russia or in parts of the Canadian High Arctic, just because you can travel commercially to a lot of the places that we work out of.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a logistics issue about being able to get out to where the bears are and being able to sustain a presence long enough to acquire enough samples of individuals or observations, whatever your study demands. Alongside that, there's the cost. It's really, really expensive to work in the Arctic. It's really expensive to work over the sea ice. There's also a safety factor.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're putting people at risk anytime you're flying aircraft, you know, fair distances over the sea ice. So those are the primary considerations. I think there are plenty of people that are willing to do the work if the resources were available. In terms of, you know, what the future holds for polar bears, I think that it's really important to recognize that, you know, polar bears have evolved over a long period of time. It's debatable over how, you know, when polar bears diverge from a common ancestor with brown bears, but they've evolved to make a living over the ice cap for at least a couple hundred thousand years. And their environment is changing at a rate now that is probably going to outpace their ability to naturally evolve new behaviors to cope with kind of the new environmental conditions that they're experiencing. And really, you know, the other issue is that these new environmental conditions aren't all, it's not a state of change from one type of condition to another. It's a constantly changing set of conditions that they're having to deal with. It's primarily the loss of sea ice habitat, but also increased human activities, industrial development, economic development, recreation. So it's not, you know, they're kind of trying to adjust their behaviors to a moving target, and I think that makes it more challenging. Going back to those 19 subpopulations, there are a couple of subpopulations that are really well studied. They're, you know, they have research that's able to sustain itself from year to year in most cases. And for those 3 subpopulations, there have been documentation of recent declines in abundance that are related to sea ice, also declines in body condition, so the nutritional condition of animals that tend to kind of happen before you see declines in abundance. That said, there are other subpopulations that appear to be doing okay. For example, Baffin Bay. It's likely that Baffin Bay subpopulation might have increased in recent years. Hmm. And these are all consistent with projections that were done around the time that the decision was made in the U.S. to list polar bears as threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
One of the products that informed that decision was a projection of polar bear population status through the end of the century. And kind of the take-home message from that effort was that in the near term, there's going to be a lot of variability in how individual subpopulations respond to changing environmental conditions. Some subpopulations at the southern end of polar bear's range will probably begin to experience adverse effects of climate change sooner. Other populations that are kind of, you know, more in the Canadian high Arctic at higher latitudes will probably see improvements in population vital rates as the sea ice actually becomes thinner and it becomes better hunting habitat.
Ah, right.
But that'll be a transient improvement because eventually you'll lose that sea ice.
Yeah.
And bears will be forced to shore for longer and longer periods of time. And once bears spend upwards of 4 or 5 months on land, then it makes it energetically very difficult for them to sustain reproduction, sustain the amount of body fat they need to reproduce successfully.
Yeah.
And at that point, you'll start to see declines in even some of the high Arctic subpopulations. But that's probably not until, you know, the middle of the century where we can expect to see that. So that means that there's still, you know, some time to avert those outcomes if you can mitigate greenhouse gas emissions and conserve sea ice.
I mean, are you, one of the questions are you asking is, are bears going to migrate? I mean, is that going to be, are you even seeing any patterns yet that show or suggest that bears are recognizing the change in sea ice, those southern populations that you're referencing, or the southern edge, are they moving north, or do you expect that?
You know, what we're seeing is kind of what I refer to as a behavioral scramble, as bears are trying different types of behaviors to cope with the rapidly changing environmental conditions. So there are parts of the polar bear range. We talked about Southern Hudson Bay and Western Hudson Bay and Baffin Bay. Those subpopulations are in a region of the Arctic, which we call the seasonal ice ecoregion.
Yeah.
And historically, that seasonal ice ecoregion has been characterized by sea ice that disappears almost entirely each summer. And when that happens, bears have this kind of life history trait where they just come ashore because, you know, the other option is to move north, to migrate northward, or to tread water. So what they do is they come ashore and they stay on land until the ice returns in the fall. Other parts of the Arctic, ice has historically been present year-round, and so bears would just remain on the ice year-round.
Yeah.
In the southern Beaufort, where I do my work, which is kind of at, you know, it's one of those kind of southern peripheral populations, we've seen it transition into kind of a seasonal ice area where ice is seasonally absent now in the summer and fall. And this just happened over the last 15 or so years. And bears are trying to figure out which strategy to adopt. Do they come ashore and hang out on land until the ice returns in the fall, or do they follow that ice north as it retreats, you know, over the very deep waters of the polar basin? And one thing about deep water is it's generally less biologically productive, so the hunting habitat is not as good as when it's up along the coast. So in the southern Beaufort, bears are, you know, some bears are coming ashore, others are staying with the ice. One of the things we are finding, though, is that the majority of the bears stay with the ice, and it's really a fixed behavior. Bears will, you know, they typically prefer sea ice concentration of about 50% or higher. Once the concentration of sea ice drops below 50%, they're not particularly happy. It's not really good hunting habitat for them. That said, they'll stay on sea ice concentration that is, you know, below 15% just to stay on the sea ice. It's bad hunting habitat because it's highly fragmented habitat, and it's really vulnerable to the forces that kind of move ice around. But that kind of genetically fixed behavior to stay on the sea ice is so strong that they're just reluctant to do anything other than that. So, you know, I think that it'll be... It's tough to imagine having a robust polar bear population in the Arctic in areas where sea ice is absent for 5 or more months of the year. That probably leaves parts of the Canadian archipelago through the mid-century, end-of-century mark, where ice is available for longer periods of time throughout the year. But that'll be a relatively small area, and it's not like all the polar bears that are currently present will be able to, you know, make a good living if they moved up north. It would be, right. I think the density would probably be too high. So we'll probably, you know, see declines in populations, starting at the peripheral populations and then moving northward as the ice becomes less and less available.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Are there any common misconceptions that people have about polar bears that you, in the scientific community, are eager to kind of correct?
Yeah, that's actually, I'm glad you asked that. I think probably the major misconception that I hear is this notion that all polar bear populations are doing poorly, or this expectation that because all polar bear populations aren't doing poorly, that polar bears aren't vulnerable then to loss of sea ice habitat through a changing climate. And that's not what the scientific literature has ever really purported to be the case. Yeah. I think the scientific literature is pretty consistent in that the threats to polar bears, the primary threat is loss of sea ice habitat. That is happening. We are seeing responses in some subpopulations, adverse responses to the loss of sea ice habitat, but that there's a lot of geographic variation in the changes in sea ice habitat. Some places have changed quite a bit, some places haven't yet changed that much, and in some cases, places that change are actually going to improve temporarily and be better hunting habitat for bears. So this idea that all bears everywhere should be doing poorly now is just not consistent with the scientific literature, which predicts that, you know, the most adverse consequences to the circumpolar population aren't expected to happen until at least the mid-century mark. So that would be the first thing that I'd like people to kind of consider. The other thing is this idea that polar bears are you know, kind of a threat to people. And I think it's, you know, it's easy to view them that way. I mean, they're a big animal. In some cases, they're termed hypercarnivores because their diet is, in terms of a carnivore, their diet is extreme for a carnivore. And, you know, they eat very little else than other animals.
Yeah.
But they're very intelligent animals. They're very used in many places of the Arctic to coexisting with people. And, you know, while there hasn't been a lot of studies done looking at human-polar bear interactions and particularly human-polar bear conflict, the few studies that are out there indicate that adverse interactions between people and polar bears are usually triggered by people. It's, you know, tourists getting too close to animals, not being able to read that an animal is becoming stressed and wants you to move away. It's people in communities where polar bears come to shore, not taking proper care of their garbage and their subsistence food items, so food storage is an issue. There was a paper that was published a few years back that looked at you know, the relative threat that polar bears pose to people in terms of attacks. And they combed through the historical literature. They looked at data from 1870 through 2014 and were only able to come up with 73 instances of polar bears attacking people. Hmm. 20 of those 73 attacks were fatal. And that sounds like a lot, but it really isn't when you compare it just to black bear attacks. So from 1900 to 2009, there have been 63 fatal attacks by black bears, much less, you know, interactions that just result in either no injury or some injury to people. So, you know, the idea that polar bears are a threat to people is, I think, a little bit overinflated. I think it's more the reverse, that people are a larger threat to polar bears.
So we've come to the end of episode 57, Polar Bear. We want to thank Dr. Todd Atwood for joining us from Anchorage to discuss the fate of the polar bear, the current situation of the polar bear. Important for us in this two-part series, I think first to have the scientific perspective, and in next month's second episode dedicated to the polar bear, we will look at the poster bear, as I'm going to call it, the polar bear in the media, the poster species or icon of climate change communication in the popular press. And so we're going to invite Dr. Dorothea Born from Central Europe, currently living in Munich, to join us to discuss her research looking at popular science media and how they've framed the polar bear as sort of the icon of climate change. Stay tuned for that. As always, we want to thank Mike Allen for use of his song, Sand Dune, that you can hear now. Join us in celebrating 5 years of Geographical Imaginations this month. We started back in October in Salzburg, Austria, in Studio B. Now we're in Studio O in Pennsylvania. Ciao.